This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. The Trump administration has just released a set of guidelines for visa applicants from six nations that were singled out in the Muslim ban, which the president has been trying to implement since he took office. The guidelines are in response to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to take on legal challenges to Trump's executive orders this fall. Shockingly, justices voted unanimously to allow a partial version of the ban to take effect immediately, which the new set of guidelines are attempting to follow. New visa applicants from Syria, Sudan, Somalia, Libya, Iran, and Yemen must now show that they have a, quote, bona fide relationship with someone in the U.S. When Mr. Trump first issued his first version of the Muslim ban in January, chaos and confusion abounded at airports around the country as incoming tourists, students, and even refugees were held in detention, with some having their visas revoked and many simply sent back. Numerous lower court judges struck down that and a subsequent version of the ban before the Supreme Court decided to revive it. My guest is Noor Zafar. She is the Bertha Justice Institute Fellow at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to the program, Noor.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first, explain what it was that the Supreme Court said was a partial implementation of this ban. How exactly did the Supreme Court qualify the, I'm assuming, second version of Trump's Muslim ban, saying that it could go into effect immediately before they take up the case in October?
Right. So I think, you know, what the Supreme Court really tried to do here was kind of satisfy both the plaintiffs and the government. And that's why if you kind of read the news accounts on, you know, how different organizations are interpreting this ban, it really depends on who you ask. And that'll give you a sense of, you know, whether the ban was upheld or if it wasn't. So, but from our point of view, you know, as you mentioned, this ban this ruling essentially leaves in place the ban, but it carves out an exception based on a, quote, bona fide relationship that people might have to the United States. Now, the court kind of offered some specific guidance on what would constitute a bona fide relationship. So that's, you know, if people coming in on visas have these relationships, then the ban will not apply to them. But the Trump administration just released guidelines yesterday really interpreting this bona fide relationship narrowly. So basically, if you're an immigrant or non-immigrant trying to visit the country, you must show that you're either visiting a member of your nuclear family or in-laws. Anyone outside of that does not qualify as a bona fide relationship, and those people would be subject to the ban. So the Supreme Court really carved out a narrow exception to the ban, but by and large, the ban still holds because embassies and consulates making these determinations in the home countries are allowed to, you know, essentially deny visas for people who can't show this bona fide relationship.
And so, did the Supreme Court make it clear what it meant by a bona fide relationship?
It offered some examples. So, for example, it said, you know, if you're visiting a family member. Now, it didn't define what a family member was, and I think that's where you had the Trump administration coming in with their very narrow interpretation of what constitutes a family member. And this interpretation kind of contravenes a lot of international and refugee law as with regard to who really constitutes a family member. So while the court didn't expressly lay that out, and we anticipate this being maybe one point of future litigation until the case is decided on the merits, the court gave examples, but one thing that it did say, you know, clearly that would not qualify as a bona fide relationship, for example, would be, legal organizations, advocacy organizations that seek out plaintiffs for the express purpose of challenging the ban. So such people would not have a bona fide relationship.
So then the Trump administration issued its guidelines on Wednesday saying that it defined bona fide relationship as visiting a parent or a child or I understand a sibling possibly, but not a grandparent or nieces and nephews.
Precisely. So it's, yeah, it's just that it's parents or siblings and in-laws, but, you know, excluded from that, for example, is grandparents. And it's really, you know, pretty arbitrary where, you know, the decision to include, in-laws as part of a bona fide relationship, but to exclude grandparents.
Wow.
So yeah, again, I think, you know, just as a, in, it, you know, it's a very arbitrary determination that I think is really going to be met with some legal challenges.
So does this now, when the first airport ban went immediately into effect, causing all that chaos in January, it was people who had already obtained visas, you know, possibly months before that were turned away because they happen to be from these six countries. Who does this narrow version of this ban apply to? Do current visa holders get exempted? Does it only apply to new visa applicants?
So again, according to the government's guidelines, it does not apply to current visa holders. So people who possessed visas as of June 29th, today when it goes into effect. But, you know, that being said, I think there, you know, there's always a difference between what technically and legally is permissible and how things are actually implemented on the ground. Because the individuals who will be implementing this Supreme Court's order are going to be people at embassies and consulates or Customs and Border Patrol and potentially even, you know, airline agents. So I think it really we'll find out later this evening when the ban kicks in, you know, how it's actually being implemented on the ground. But
wow.
As to the kind of tech of who it applies to, it does not apply to current visa holders. But in practice, we might see some more chaos ensuing.
So we saw in January, for example, people with student visas coming to study in the United States who had obtained their admissions and visas ahead of time being turned away. This technically wouldn't apply to them, even if they were from these countries.
Correct. And that was another example that the Supreme Court mentioned explicitly with regard to people who do demonstrate bona fide relationships. It's students who have acceptance letters from universities and who have their visas and are ready to come in. So those people, according to the Supreme Court's ruling, should be exempt from the ban.
I see. And it's going to be really interesting to see Border Patrol agents, customs, border officials at airports, you know, have these guidelines in place, what the Supreme Court said, what the Trump administration has said, when it goes into effect. So visa applicants, new visa applicants going forward would be people applying for tourist visas and student visas. What about refugee asylum?
So the interesting thing about the Supreme Court ruling is that this bona fide relationship test also applies to refugees, which is a bit more, I mean, it's troubling because these people, you know, people who apply to be refugees are often, they don't necessarily have that relationship with the U.S. that would qualify as a bona fide relationship. But
they're fleeing violence, usually.
Exactly. So, you know, the criteria by which we measure whether to let refugees in is not predicated on this bona fide relationship test. But by adding that element into the calculation, I think the refugees might be particularly adversely impacted by the Supreme Court's ruling.
Now,
because they too have to demonstrate this bona fide relationship, which in many cases just doesn't exist.
So visa applicants going forward would, from these six countries we mentioned, would be subject to these new rules or guidelines. But for how long? The original ban that Trump put into effect was meant to be a temporary ban. Does the Supreme Court say for that same length of time this ban is to take effect, or is it sort of indefinite or until the Supreme Court makes its ruling in October?
Right. So one of the big issues is whether or not this ban issue will be moot by the time the Supreme Court hears oral arguments in October. And in fact, that's one of the questions that the court asks the government and the plaintiffs to brief in its arguments. But, you know, after the lower courts kind of almost unanimously issued these injunctions banning the ban, the Trump administration essentially came out with new guidance saying that this 90-day suspension is not going to take effect until these injunctions are uplifted. So the 90-day clock actually now kicks in starting today and will run up to right before October when the case should be heard. So that's kind of an open question about whether this whole issue is going to be moot by the time it's actually adjudicated on the merits. But until then, at least for the next 90 days, the Supreme Court's decision applies.
And today being Thursday, our audience will likely hear and watch this program on Friday. So why do you think the Supreme Court did what it did? I mean, I'm trying to make sense of this. All nine justices, including the liberal justices, you know, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer. I mean, how did they sign off on this? Because even if it's narrowly defined in its implementation, even if it's temporary, what they've basically said is put a symbolic stamp of approval on something that the Trump administration is trying to do that almost everybody else has decided was unconstitutional.
No, you're absolutely correct in that. And I think this ruling, this unanimous ruling by the court, just indicates how much, you know, the resistance to this ban and resistance to Trump's, you know, racist, xenophobic, Islamophobic policies across the board ultimately is going to be through organizers, through organized communities, and through people-powered movements. And we can only rely on the courts so much. And I think that the court's, you know, ruling in this travel ban case explicitly proves that we can't rely on institutions of the state to really uphold fundamental rights. And it's interesting, you know, three of the conservative justices dissented from that, indicating not only, you know, that they would want this ban to go into effect for the next 90 days, but also indicating the way that they would vote on the merits, being that they would actually uphold the ban despite, you know, all of the troubling history of bigoted Islamophobic remarks that
and
we know inform this.
Which three are those?
That was Justice Gorsuch, Alito, and Thomas.
Right. So the three most conservative members of the court. Right now, lower court judges had said what Donald Trump said in the lead up to his election and inauguration about implementing a Muslim ban should be fair game when judging the travel ban on its merit, that the travel ban was really a Muslim ban, which so clearly violates our constitution. So these lower court judges were saying it's fair game. If this is what the person said it was going to be, we need to examine their intent in order to judge this going forward. I suppose the three conservative justices at the very least don't consider Trump's own words to be standards that they should judge this ban by?
Correct. I mean, it's difficult to say, you know, what exactly informed their kind of dissent or concurrence and possibly allowing the ban to continue. But I think it is fair to say that when it comes down to if this case is heard on the merits in October, I think we can anticipate that at least those three conservative justices who voted to uphold the ban in its entirety would say that Trump's, you know, bigoted, racist, Islamophobic statements, both pre-election and post-election, should not be taken into account. But, you know, it's really hard to separate that out. And as you mentioned, the lower courts consistently have found that we can't divorce this policy from the very clear, you know, intent that informed it.
Well, can you divorce it from reality as well, right? Because if the whole goal of this Muslim ban is to protect the country from terrorism, shouldn't the Trump administration be required to show, to demonstrate that people from these countries applying for these kinds of visas have clearly shown, you know, some risk or you know, there have been past incidents of terrorism in the United States? Shouldn't they be required to actually make the case? Because if they were required to make that case, suddenly Saudi Arabia might be on that. Maybe the United Arab Emirates might be on that list.
Correct. They should absolutely. I mean, if their argument is that individuals from these countries pose a disproportionate risk to the national security of the United States, then they should be offering facts to prove this claim. And the fact that they were not able to offer these statistics to bear out their claims is exactly why the lower courts prevented this ban in its entirety from being upheld. And So I think, you know, that the factual data just doesn't bear out this this claim. And I think the Trump administration would respond to that. And I think a lot of conservative justices would agree with this argument, is that the executive, when it comes to determining the nation's immigration policies, has very broad powers to determine who is let in and who is not. And I think that's more of the angle that the Trump administration is going for. And we heard that in the oral arguments in some of the lower court cases, where essentially the Trump government argues that in the realm of immigration, in the realm of national security, the president has pretty much unlimited power, power that is not reviewable by the courts to determine who is let in and who is let out. And I think that's kind of one of the crux of the issue, is the executive's power so unbounded that he can use a discriminatory pretext for national security purposes?
Now, Noor, which version of the travel ban is taking partial effect and is being considered, whose challenge is being considered by the court, version one or version two, the more watered down version?
So it's version two that's being considered, because version two, the second executive order nullified the first order.
Right,
so
I see.
It's the second version that's being considered.
Which Trump, when that version, the second version, was struck down by lower courts, angrily said on Twitter that they should have stuck to their guns and not opted for the watered down version. You know, I mean, he kind of just admitted that what he really wants is the more the stronger version, the more problematic, constitutionally problematic version. So what do you think will happen at airports? And are you hearing any reports through your organization of activists and lawyers who might be showing up to airports on Thursday night, Friday, and the following days, like they did in January, when there was so much chaos at the airport, when people's loved ones were being held in detention and or deported? Do you expect the airport protests to revive now?
Sure. Well, we definitely have reports from allies on the ground that there will be people going to the airport both to protest what's, still a Muslim ban, and then also lawyers and legal personnel are being deployed to airports where there's flights coming in from the six banned countries to be on standby in case individuals have problems getting in. So yes, I think kind of the legal and organizing community is ready to show up to airports, just as they did with the last two iterations of the ban, in case that there's some issues.
And if there are people whose loved ones are hoping to get visa applications in, are looking for any kind of legal guidelines or guidance as to what they can expect, can you recommend any websites or anything any resources?
Yes, well, I think for, because immigration varies so much on a case-by-case basis, it's really best for individuals to consult with individual lawyers who can kind of speak to their specific circumstances. But any host of national immigration advocacy organizations have, fact sheets and FAQs posted on their websites that outline some of just like the basic contours of what the Supreme Court's ruling means.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, speaking of immigration, as you and I are speaking on Thursday, the House is planning to vote on two immigration bills, the No Sanctuary for Criminals Act and Kate's Law. We'll be bringing coverage of that on our program in the coming days. Noor, give out a website for the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Yes, our website is ccrjustice.org.
And we'll post a link to that. Go ahead.
Yes, and we also on Twitter will be providing updates for both actions that are happening in New York City and linking to different resources that people can access. And that our Twitter handle is @theCCR.
@theCCR, and the website ccrjustice.org. We'll post links to those from our website. Thanks so much, Noor.
Thank you.
My guest is Noor Zafar. She's the Bertha Justice Institute Fellow at the Center for Constitutional Rights. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.